This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Enemies Within the Church, a documentary that will expose the false teachers and underlying agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world. For more information, visit enemieswithinthechurch.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Well, we have talked in the past about the issue of interfaith dialogue, and we have seen how this mantra of building bridges has been used in the cause of Chrislam, for example, where there's a merging of Islam and Christianity. We've seen some of the more liberal mainline denominations enamored with this idea of joining hands with Muslims and coming together and building bridges of all sorts. But now my next guest is noting that through the process of interfaith dialogue, Michigan's secondary schools and institutes of higher learning, as well as its churches and synagogues, are really under assault to indoctrinate traditional America into accepting the alien, counter-constitutional doctrines of Sharia. But even worse, those who are promoting interfaith dialogue have made evangelical Christians their prime target. It's all outlined in a new occasional paper for the Center for Security Policy. It's called Michigan Faith Communities in the Crosshairs. And joining us now is one of the authors of the paper, former White House budget analyst and investigative journalist Jim Simpson, also the author of the book, The Red-Green Axis. And Jim, it's great to have you back. How you been?
Hey, Janet. Great to be with you again. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know you and I have talked about interfaith dialogue in the past. You say, though, that Muslims are having a profound impact on Michigan's faith communities due to interfaith dialogue. What is going on right now?
Well, you know, Michigan is ground zero for has been for a century, a prime place where Muslim immigrants went primarily to work in the Ford plant, mm-hmm. at first anyway, and established, a thriving community there. And for decades, it was just a community like pretty much everybody else, although as the Middle Eastern conflict heated up, they tended to gravitate towards the wrong side. There are people in Dearborn area that side with Hezbollah publicly.
Wow.
We were writing about Michigan, but this can be applied nationwide. And Michigan, perhaps it's more advanced because it has such a large Muslim community, but it's happening like this all over the place. And the paper discusses how in Western Michigan, which is historically, a very Christian area, the supposedly Christian universities and organizations there and churches have been sucked into this just like everybody else, and their pastors now behave just the same way as somebody from the radical left when they're confronted with questions about what they're doing, and when it's pointed out to them that Sharia law is incompatible with the U.S. Constitution, and you can't really marry Christianity and Islam, and they just don't want to hear it.
Right.
It's like what is happening in all over our culture and our society. People just do not want to be told the truth about what's going on.
Right. Well, for some of these people who are engaged in interfaith dialogue, they see it as an opportunity to make friends across religious cultures. And it's not that we're going to become Muslims, but we want to understand our neighbors better. Can you outline for people, though, you go into great detail in your paper about Islam and the left and how they are leveraging interfaith dialogue for more nefarious purposes than just having dinner with your neighbor. What is really going on when you have people initiating interfaith dialogue, particularly with Christian congregations? What are they after?
Well, you know, you really have to look at the history of it. The interfaith dialogue was introduced to faith communities in the United States by the World Council of Churches.
Yes.
And the World Council of Churches is a flat-out communist organization. It was one of the focal points of the longstanding communist effort to infiltrate the church in America.
Yeah.
And as you know, from Bela Dodd and others, you know, they began with the Catholic Church and at the same time going into the mainline Protestant churches as early as the 1930s, probably before. And so they have long targeted Christianity because they know that Christianity is where America gets its strength. It gets its moral strength. And if so they can subvert that, they can subvert our nation. You know, they can defeat us without firing a shot. And, you know, the Muslims weren't always, I shouldn't say the Muslims, because that's really not accurate. The Muslim Brotherhood and other organizations promoting political Islam as a vehicle for them to obtain power they didn't always side with the communist left. I mean, in World War II, they sided with Hitler. Mm-hmm. But Hitler, of course, went away after World War II.
Yes.
And so they rejoined with the communists. And most people know that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood really preached a socialist form of Islam. You know, they wanted to combine socialist principles with Islamic law, and that's not new. But you know, my friend Frank Gaffney has a very good statement that he quotes here. And I'll just read what I wrote. Interfaith dialogue is often referred as, quote, building bridges, and some programs are specifically so named. But as Frank Gaffney, president of Center for Security Policy, has said, quote, while the interfaith dialogue movement presents itself as a laudable effort to bridge the distance between faiths, those more familiar with the doctrine of the Muslim Brotherhood know that the actual agenda of too many such efforts is, in fact, modeled after the well-known dictum of Sayyid Qutb, who was a very prominent Muslim Brotherhood leader,
yes,
who candidly reminded Muslims that such a, quote, bridge is only so that the people of the Jahiliya, Society of Unbelievers, may come over to Islam.
Right, right.
So the interfaith dialogue invites participation from from Christians and Jews, and to, you know, a small extent other faiths, but it's primarily targeted towards Christianity and Christians in this country because Christianity is the main enemy. They knock that off and they control our country. And it's another angle on the effort that was initiated by the Frankfurt School in the 1930s to subvert our culture, to destroy our culture, to destroy Christianity, to pollute our culture with sexual deviance and other things as a weapon. It's a weapon. You know, all of the cultural degeneracy that we see today is a direct consequence of the efforts of the Frankfurt School intellectuals who were transplanted to the Columbia Teachers College in the 1930s and spread their poison throughout the Ivy League colleges, and with the knowing complicity of the first director of the National Education Association. And so the NEA can also promote those ideas too. So that's why we're seeing, you know, sex education to kindergartners, and now we're seeing just bizarre manifestations of that. You know, they have transgender people teaching kindergartners in California.
And all the rest.
I mean, it's gone crazy.
It is. Jim, hang on. We have to go to a break. We'll come back with Jim Simpson talking about Michigan faith communities in the crosshairs. We'll come back on Janet Mefford Today. Socialism is being purposely dressed up in Christian choir robes by once trusted and very influential church leaders. Their gatherings are growing in numbers as they shelve the true gospel and replace it with a false one known as the social gospel. What is this agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world? And whatever happened to powerful biblical Christianity? Noted producers Judd Saul, Trevor Loudon, Curtis Bowers, and Pastor Kerry Gordon of Cornerstone Church have joined forces to create enemies within the church, a hard-hitting international documentary that will reveal the plans and the players behind this movement and shine a bright light of restoration and hope upon Christ's church. To stay updated about this film and learn how you can support this important effort, go to enemieswithinthechurch.com and subscribe to the Enemies Within the Church newsletter. While you're there, be sure to enjoy a sneak peek of the movie. Go now to enemieswithinthechurch.com, sponsored by Cornerstone World Outreach International. That's enemieswithinthechurch.com. I like to read, and whenever I can, I like to read the Puritans. John Gerstner once said that the Puritans constituted the greatest movement in the church since the days of the apostles. That's quite an endorsement. I'd like to recommend a publisher committed to the writings of these godly men. It's called Northampton Press. Men such as Jonathan Edwards, Thomas Watson, Jeremiah Burroughs, and John Bunyan are just a few of the great preachers they've put back into print for us. Many of these titles have not been available since the 1600s, but now they are in print. These books have been retypeset, slightly updated for modern readers, and printed in such a way as to last hundreds of years. I can personally recommend them to you, having read many of them myself. Mention Janet Mefford in the comment section of the order form and receive a free copy of the book Law and Liberty, A Biblical Look at Legalism with any purchase. For more information, visit their website at northamptonpress.org. And remember, it's N-O-R-T, hamptonpress.org. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Great to have you with us, and great to have with us Jim Simpson, investigative journalist, author of The Red-Green Axis, and co-author of the new occasional paper over at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. You can take a look at it, and you really should read the whole thing. It's called Michigan Faith Communities in the Crosshairs, and it really outlines what is going on in Michigan, but sounds the alarm for Christians across the United States of America on the issue of interfaith dialogue and how the left and the Islamic community are leveraging really cultural Marxism and also the doctrine of Sharia to try to deliberately target the Christian community and try to soften us up so we can be subjugated. It sounds like some big conspiracy theory, Jim, but you know what you're talking about here. Talk a little bit, for example, just to get into some specifics about this, because you say evangelical Christians are the prime targets, and I've seen this. We're beginning to see more evangelical pastors. Oh, we really need to have a dialogue, and it makes my head hurt. But for example, Calvin College, you point out, in Michigan, was once a very trusted conservative college, but has drifted leftward. How have they been involved in this interfaith dialogue effort, for example?
Well, you know, they put together conferences where they have different leaders attend and talk about the interfaith dialogue. And there was one, I'm trying to find it, that was more Bill Johnson's bailiwick, because he was the person who actually attended those conventions. But there was one that was held the day after the shooting at San Bernardino, California, the day after. And there was there were teachers from Calvin College, and not one of them mentioned the San Bernardino terrorist attack.
The day after.
The day after.
Yeah.
They didn't talk about any of the any of the various problems with radical Islam, you know, Sharia law, honor killings, the caliphate, any of that stuff, and they didn't even mention the San Bernardino terrorist attack. They just do not want to wander onto that terrain, because then they can no longer sit around in the nice, warm, touchy-feely atmosphere of we're all friends here.
Right, we're all buddies.
Let's all, can't we all just get along? And,
yeah.
You know, and of course they get Islamic imams and other people who are smooth as silk in reinforcing that idea. But, you know, it's really just another side of the same coin that we see with everything that the radical left does. I mean, what are you called if you oppose anything that the radical left promotes?
Bigot, homophobe, Islamophobe.
Hater, Islamophobe. Yeah, name your phobe.
Yes.
And so the interfaith dialogue is, it's an information operation that's designed to lure you. It has a carrot and a stick. Now, everybody is aware of Islamic terrorism, and everybody, when they first think of Islam, it's probably what most people think of, right?
Sure.
And so they have prepared in advance a response. You know, anybody that talks about those negative aspects is immediately an Islamophobe. And of course, when those types of epithets, slanderous words are tossed around and become mainstream, part of the mainstream narrative, people are naturally intimidated. They don't want to be painted with that brush any more than anybody wants to be painted as a racist.
Right.
Right? It has the same kind of negative connotation. And you know, I know, that when we speak the truth about these issues, a lot of people, even our friends who know better, shy away from us, simply because they don't want to suffer guilt by association.
Sure. Yep.
It's the natural human herd instinct to go where it's safe. And so they know all these things. This is all psychological warfare. So they create this interfaith dialogue, and that's the carrot. The interfaith dialogue is your way out. It's your way to announce that you are not an Islamophobe, that you're not a hater.
Yes.
So you can join the interfaith dialogue, and you've got plenty of institutional backup for that. There's over 90 main interfaith dialogue organizations in the United States, and that's just the big ones. And there are numerous ones in Michigan. And so it all has the patina of this very official and accepted type of idea. And so there it is. You can go and go into a nice, warm, safe place by joining with them and avoid the negative brush of being called an Islamophobe or a bigot.
Well, they're working on us in many ways because, for example, for the Christian, we're to fulfill the Great Commission, which is to go into all the world and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. We're to evangelize the Muslim population. Right. When you're having dialogue, all of a sudden that disarms you, as you mentioned, kind of a psychological warfare. They no longer, they understand this. No longer will you see them as someone who needs to be saved and I need to evangelize them. Now it's, he's my buddy, he's my pal, I don't want to make any waves, right?
Exactly. I want to let him know that I'm friendly. I'm not one of those Islamophobes. I'm a nice guy.
Yeah, and nobody was to begin with. Jim, this is the really dishonest part about it. Islamophobe, that's a term the Muslim Brotherhood loves.
Created
and loves and pushes on people to make them feel guilty for something they're not guilty of. And when I look at how the evangelical church is becoming more and more subject to these fear tactics without close examination, for example, when Islam, as you mentioned in your article, adopts the language of the left, it doesn't talk so much about Sharia. It talks about racism or intolerance or diversity or justice and stuff like that. This is just the same stuff that the left does to try to disarm people. What is the best response, would you say, particularly for evangelical churches, whom you've said are the prime target? What should evangelical pastors and individuals in evangelical congregations do to guard against this?
Well, first of all, they have to understand what it is. And, anybody who reads this occasional paper, if they haven't already closed their mind, will have their eyes open to exactly what it is, because there's no gray area in what we put together here. This is all just facts from day one, and it shows the progression, the development of this notion, who developed it, where it came from, and it was all from very dangerous people who are enemies of this country and have a very specific agenda, really. I mean, I call it an asymmetrical military campaign to overthrow the West. What I call it.
Wow.
That's what I call it, because that's really what it is. You have to think of this in military terms. You don't think of it in political terms or issues. It's not about issues. It's not about politics. It's a military campaign of conquest against the West. And of course, they know that we have a strong military, so they're not going to come at us directly that way. They come at us by subverting our society, by using its own institutions against us.
Well, like the Muslim, the civilization jihad, which is the mantra of the Muslim Brotherhood. You destroy from within. This is a great tactic for doing it. And as you mentioned in your article, it has the side effect of putting Christians at war with one another, because now you have some who will do the interfaith. Some do the interfaith dialogue, and the people like me who would say, bad idea. Now we're the problem. Now you've got Christianity divided.
It really is. I wrote, about the article I wrote about Mr. White.
Yes, and James White.
Yep. Oh my gosh.
Yes. I do remember that. Yes, I do. It's a problem.
Some of the components, some of these stories that Bill Johnson, and he is a very strong evangelical Christian, relates in his experience, is his effort to speak with some of these so-called Christian pastors. And some of them were very prominent Christian pastors, and they were rude. I mean, they were just downright, outright rude to him. Said, "We don't want to talk to you. Yeah. We know where you're coming from. We don't want to hear it. Get away from here."
Right. It's in your article.
There's nothing. The behavior is about as Christian as, Howard Stern. it's amazing, but it shows you how powerful the herd instinct and survival instinct is in people, where they just throw all of their Christian knowledge out the window, throw all of their humility out the window.
Yep. For what? Exactly. Well, it's Michigan Faith Communities in the Crosshairs at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. Jim Simpson, thanks so much, Jim, and we'll be right back. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Enemies Within the Church, a documentary that will expose the false teachers and underlying agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world. For more information, visit enemieswithinthechurch.com. We are back on Janet Meffer Today. Did you see that report on what Americans find to be giving them meaning in their lives? This happened over the last couple of days. The BBC News reported on this new Pew Research Center poll. Asked to rate what gave their life meaning, researchers found more people mentioned career and money than friends or religion. Two-thirds of those surveyed said family was a source of satisfaction. Number one, family, 69%. Number two was career at 34%, money at 23%. Coming in at number four was faith and spirituality gives Americans meaning in life. Well, your family does mean something to you. Your family ought to mean a lot to you. Your family ought to be a big, big, big deal in your life. But your family is definitely not to be higher if you're a Christian than your faith in Jesus Christ. Deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me. He who loves his father or mother more than he loves me is not worthy of me. It's not that you are to despise your family by any means if you're a Christian. We understand that what Jesus was really saying is he needs to be paramount in everything in our lives. And that's what it means to be a Christian. So again, we're seeing evidence that in the American culture, Jesus and Christianity is becoming less and less of a big deal to people, which isn't any surprise to us. Now, this was rather interesting. Raymond Arroyo was sitting in for Laura Ingraham over on Fox News and discussed this a little bit with Family Research Council President Tony Perkins and friendly atheist Hemant Mehta. This was kind of interesting how they came down on it. Listen to Tony. Cut one.
I'm thrilled by this, that family is so high ranked in this survey, that people say that family is where they get their sense of meaning. That's actually a positive revival of family, if you will. I think if you look at how the United States, how the economy is doing in the United States, unemployment is low. Mm-hmm. It's not surprising that religion actually drops down lower in this list. It's still fourth. That's actually still pretty good, considering what's happening in other industrialized nations. When there's a downturn in the economy, when things start to fall apart, that's when people turn to religion. So sociology, from a sociological standpoint, I think this is accurate. From a theological standpoint, it is a bit troubling.
Well, from a theological standpoint, it's a lot troubling. You should not pay more attention to your career is giving you meaning in life than you do to your faith in Jesus Christ, if in fact that's what your faith is. Of course, these things really have to be analyzed sociologically, don't they? Because if you say faith in spirituality, faith in whom? Faith in what? It's not good to have faith in a false God or faith in yourself or a spirituality that embraces Wicca, for crying out loud. You have to define your terms. So I can't just say on a blanket level, it's great if people put faith in spirituality number one. That may be the worst possible thing if, in fact, the majority of Americans put their faith in a false God or a false hope of some kind. Aside from Jesus Christ, what does faith even mean? Faith is a gift of God, and believing in his name is what brings life. So there's that as well. Now, Hemant Mehta, the atheist, was asked to weigh in on the order of things where family came first and faith came fourth. This was cut two.
It doesn't surprise me one bit that people find meaning in family and experiences. Mm-hmm. And what actually surprised me the least about this is when they looked at young people specifically, I think faith became less of a meaningful experience for people who were younger than the age of 30. So it shows that faith has a lot of trouble moving ahead in the future, regardless of what the economic situation or social situation is
in. All right. Well, that's another point. I actually don't disagree with him necessarily. We have to look at the trends in the younger generations to see what the future might look like pertaining to faith. And of course, Hemant Mehta's whole deal is criticizing Christianity. If you read his stuff over at his blog, you know that. Not that you necessarily need to read him. He's not somebody necessarily worth reading. But at any rate, that's kind of where it is. Now, I've been paying attention to what's been going on beyond the scope of just a Pew Research Center poll, and I found this to be quite troubling. LifeSite News just pointed out this Nature magazine editorial. Did you hear about this? They did an editorial a little while ago criticizing the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under President Trump for proposing to establish a legal definition of whether somebody is male or female based on biology. Genetic testing, as they point out, could be used to resolve any ambiguity about external appearance. The move would make it easier for institutions receiving federal funds to discriminate against people on the basis of their gender identity. There's no such thing as a gender identity. The memo claims that processes for deciding the sex on a birth certificate will be clear, grounded in science, objective, and administrable. The proposal is a terrible idea, Nature says, that should be killed off. It has no foundation in science. Excuse me. Did you just get through saying that male or female has no foundation in science? It has complete foundation in science. This is absurd. They say it would undo decades of progress on understanding sex, a classification based on internal and external bodily characteristics, and gender, a social construct related to biological differences, but also rooted in culture, societal norms, and individual behavior. This is why I don't like the word gender, because sex is a biological reality. Gender is sometimes used as an alternate word to describe sex, a synonym for sex, but it really isn't in the minds of these liberals. It really is a social construct. That's not how we have to look at these things. It's male or female. That's how God made us, male or female, with an infinitesimal number of people who have abnormalities in their chromosomal makeup, but even then you have an ability to decide which sex the person is. Worse, it would undermine efforts, they say, to reduce discrimination against transgender people and those who do not fall into the binary categories of male or female. Again, we're back to the transgender issue, which is, again, ridiculous. These are people with gender dysphoria. They need help. They need assistance. But they need, more than anything else, people who are outside their experience to bring them into reality and to do everything that is necessary to bring them into reality and to not try to affirm their error. This is why Dr. Paul McHugh at Johns Hopkins, which pioneered the sex change operations, stopped doing them. So we have to stop doing this because it isn't helping people. Changing their biological reality does not change the main problem, which is going on in their minds. And this is just not allowed. Dr. McHugh is skewered. He is attacked. He is made into just a horrible, horrible villain for saying something that everyone should be listening to, because he was head, the psychiatrist in chief at Johns Hopkins, which pioneered sex change operations. You would think people would listen to him just because of his position and his knowledge and his breadth of experience on this issue. But if you're politically incorrect on the rainbow issue these days, we all know what happens to you. Now, Tony Perkins and Hemant Mehta talked about the Nature editorial as well. This was interesting to listen to Mehta's point of view. Listen to cut three.
Look, this administration has shown us since day one, they don't care what science experts have to say about anything involving science. They would rather trust people like Tony, who base their entire knowledge of science
on page one
of the Bible.
But Hemant, your genitalia, the way you're born, your sex does kind of tell you your gender. Isn't that scientific, Tony Perkins?
That is the least nuanced
I guess
perspective
I would call
you could possibly
that
take
look,
on
listen,
this issue.
Listen, this is what happens when people can't defend their position. They begin attacking the opposition. Look, the reality is that we base law and policy on fact, on science, on biology, not subjective feelings. And what the Trump administration is doing here is reestablishing what was in place for probably 50 years through the 1964 and 72 non-discrimination acts, where sex is based on biology, not
on
the subjective new definition of gender.
Well, then let this administration cares about science, they should talk to the people who study this stuff for a living.
Well,
they should look at organizations that
know
this information.
Nature Magazine.
And the facts would be on the side of Nature Magazine.
Yeah, Nature Magazine is a magazine.
Here,
it's not the people who do this for a living.
I don't need an education on science from someone who is known for rejecting it all the time.
Oh, my. How do you even begin to reason with people like this? And on Friday, you might have heard that Twitter made a move in its updated terms of service to prohibit targeting individuals with repeated slurs, tropes, or other content that intends to dehumanize, degrade, or reinforce negative or harmful stereotypes about a protected category. This includes targeted misgendering or dead naming of transgender individuals. So if I refer to Christine, the transgender woman who really is a man who ran for governor of Vermont, as Dave, which I did on Twitter a couple of weeks back. I guess I'm kicked off Twitter. We'll see how long I last on that platform. This should be interesting. I'm not going to stop telling the truth. We're going to come back right after this. Stay with us. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. How can Christians stand on God's word at a time when radical activists want to compromise the church on the issue of biblical sexuality? A rising tide of LGBT activism is becoming apparent inside our churches. Wearing a religious facade, these activists talk about LGBT Christians and sexual minorities, and their goal is to move our churches away from the word of God. It's time for the church to defend biblical truth without compromise. That's why I'd like to invite you to join me, Janet Mefford, at the God's Voice Conference, a biblical response to the queering of the church. Sponsored by First Stone Ministries, God's Voice will bring clarity to the confusion surrounding revoiced sexuality and identity. Our team of experts will demonstrate how the language of the LGBT Christian movement is rooted not in the Bible, but in the same ideology that has wreaked havoc on our culture. The God's Voice Conference will take place February 22nd and 23rd in Oklahoma City, and we want to see you there. It's time for the church to bow the knee to God's voice. To register or for more information, visit godsvoice.us. That's godsvoice.us. We are back on Janet Mefford today talking a little bit about transgenderism and the madness that surrounds us all the time. Twitter now has said it will prohibit misgendering and dead naming on its platform in an effort to curtail anti-trans abuse. This is from the Pink News website. The social media company has changed its rules to ban the practices and has warned that any user who deliberately targets a trans person in these ways may face permanent suspension. Well, I guess Dr. Paul McHugh won't be on Twitter, will he? Hey, Jane, you're really a man. Banned. We will not have anti-trans abuse, but I'm a doctor. Tough. Doesn't matter. This is where things are going. Now, I come around to this particular story, which I find to be quite relevant to this discussion. Did you hear about this woman in New Zealand who's transgender? Oh, it's a woman. She wants to be called they. I'm not doing that on grammatical grounds and reality grounds. This is a woman by the name of Scout Barber Evans who is pregnant. And listen to this. This is from the Stuff website in New Zealand. When Scout Barber Evans gets asked if she, I'm not going to say they, if she is expecting a boy or a girl, she has the stock answer ready. I hope it's human. Well, I think you're misspeciesizing your child. You should stop doing that. At 8 months pregnant, this part of the rainbow community woman who wishes to be referred to as they and them has been fielding a lot of side looks and intrusive comments. People ask, who's the dad? To which the single by choice woman says, it's me. My child will call me Papa. No, wrong answer. You can't be a mom and a dad. Barbara Evans used a donor as they had desperately wanted to have a child and felt it was the right time with her degree reaching completion next year and her jobs and classes being family friendly. Terrific. And she was also keen to move to the next step of her transition, getting a hysterectomy. Barbara Evans became pregnant only a few months after getting a double mastectomy. Stopping testosterone for the pregnancy and putting her transition on hold has been difficult, saying not being able to take my testosterone and anxiety and sleep medication meant that during the first trimester, I was having those 4-hour-long panic attacks, but it did normalize. Other transgender dads, meaning women, are able to hide their pregnancies, passing them off as beer bellies, but her small frame makes that impossible and causes her to be misgendered. Barbara Evans might talk openly about her gender and mental health woes in the media, but she doesn't correct people or launch into lengthy explanations every time somebody makes the wrong assumption. Now, you keep going through this whole thing, and listen to this, listen to this. Internet trolls have called her crazy and mentally ill, and she says, which I am, but it has nothing to do with my gender. I'm just going to stop right there. She has had mental health issues. It goes into more detail about her mental health issues, and you have to feel very, very sorry for her. She wrote about, in Medium, actually, she said, I wrote a lengthy story this week about my most recent admission to a psychiatric ward and the events that led to it. I got a lot of really amazing feedback. I decided as a teenager I didn't want to keep my mental illnesses a secret. I never liked how society treats mental illness, so different from physical illness. Talks about the psychiatrist that she saw. She said she was diagnosed with bipolar 2, social anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and anorexia nervosa. Horrible. She moved back to New Zealand and then was re-diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, then re-diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, an unknown mood or personality disorder, and gender dysphoria. Now, that's not even the big part of the story, because you get these kinds of stories almost routinely these days. Here's the part of the story that is so horrible. They say in this stuff piece, recent legal changes make it possible for trans and gay parents to be listed in the way they identify in relation to their children. So it's fine if this woman refers to herself as Papa, even though she's overwhelmingly mentally ill. But they're changing the laws for people like her. So what does that do to the rest of us? We all get kicked off Twitter. We have to get off Twitter because we basically hold to objective reality and we're not willing to comport to the weirdness and the loss of reality on the part of a mentally ill woman who's now pregnant by a donor and has stopped her testosterone injections. What's going on? What's really going on here? LifeSite News had a good piece, and I thought this was really relevant to this topic. And here's what they said in this piece. Once upon a time when the sexual revolution was in its infancy, social conservatives were mocked for their family values and the inherent stodginess that increasingly political phrase seemed to imply. The boring squares with their white picket fences and marriages and often string of children represented everything the sexual revolutionaries wanted to escape and everything they wanted to liberate society from. Things have changed since then. We've moved far past the implosion of traditional marriage, the rise of hookup culture, and the Playboy milieu ushered in by Hugh Hefner. Not only was gay marriage, quote unquote, imposed on all 50 states by the Supreme Court, but the transgender movement subsequently took the country by storm. With the elitist trifecta of progressive politicians, the media, and the entertainment industry obediently climbing on board with gusto. And with this second wave of the sexual revolution, the libertines changed their tactics. No longer, you'll notice, are the LGBT activists mocking family values. Instead, the rhetoric has been completely reversed. They now claim that it is their side that represents family values, and that it is social conservatives, more specifically traditionalist Christians, who pose an actual threat to those values. It is Christians, the sexual revolutionaries now state accusingly, who are homophobic, transphobic, and an active threat to their own children if they hold to the moral values that held Western civilization together for 2,000 years. It is those who hold traditional values, the LGBT activists claim, that are directly responsible for gay and trans suicides. Reversal. Reversal of right and wrong. Reversal of reality. That's what these people are doing, folks. Without the slightest sense of irony, the LGBT movement has abandoned the moral relativism they used as a philosophical vehicle to get the culture to this point and are now claiming that they are, in fact, the new moral majority. They believe that Christian adoption agencies should be shut down for declining to place children with gay couples. And anyone who weakly insists that children might be best served by both a mother and a father are furiously shouted down as bigots. Even further than that, adoption agencies and foster care are even declining to place children with Christian parents because of their Christian beliefs. Christians, the LGBT activists warn the public, are dangerous. This second wave of the sexual revolution is different from the first. They are no longer claiming that there is no such thing as objective morality and no such thing as a moral majority. They're just claiming that Christians are on the wrong side of the greatest moral questions of our day and that they now make up the new moral majority. With rates of pornography use at over 80% for men and over 50% for women, the transgender ideology sweeping through the public school system and the entire entertainment industry pumping the tenets of the sexual revolution into millions of minds per hour, their triumphalism is understandable. The sexual revolution was not only a revolution, it was a reversal and a replacement. As the remnants of Judeo-Christian morality are rooted out of the laws that govern us, they are replaced by new laws and even new definitions of biological reality. See what I'm saying? Biblical truth, in many cases, is now considered to be hate speech. Religious liberty is also a target, as the LGBT activists insist that it be subject to the new sexual dogmas that have swept our institutions. The debate has now moved beyond a discussion on how people should behave and how far the law can go in dictating such things. It is now a war over how society should order itself, a battle for the soul of our civilization. And at the moment, Christians appear to be losing badly. I think that's an important piece. I think it's way more important than I can even do justice to expressing. They're right. It's exactly what's going on. They have this piece over at NBC News from a day or two ago where they have this new report out from the Liberal Center for American Progress, the Voice for Adoption, and the North American Council on Adoptable Children, which says religious exemption laws allowing child placement agencies to deny LGBTQ prospective parents from fostering or adopting are exacerbating the current child welfare crisis. No, they're not. That's not what it is. What it is never what they say it is. What it really is they don't like the inequality that you can't give to two men what you can give to a man and a woman in the covenant of marriage. Doesn't work the same. It'll never be equal because that isn't how God created it. And it's morally wrong to do what they're doing and what they're suggesting we all should be doing. And it is going to be a train wreck of epic proportions if you hand your children over to this gigantic social experiment that we know cannot be good for society because it's rooted in a totalitarian ideology that is absolutely disconnected from right and wrong and absolutely disconnected from reality. It's Gnosticism at root. And we must continue to stay the course as biblical Christians. Faithfulness is what is needed at this hour. Thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time. We'll see you next time here on Janet Mefford Today.